This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
So urban rivers have given shape to our ever-shifting attachments to place and community. Whether nourishing residents or conveying products, fueling factories or moving waste, their water, even when considered lifeless or fetid, continue to flow, resonating human experience over time. Rivers are the critical life sources of our cities and integral to our urban landscape and to our own experience of the city. It's rarely constant. It is always in flux, for some frightening and undependable. Each of our experience develops a certain mythology, a certain narrative around the water's flow. So how do we think about these moments where the built environment converges with what we think to be natural? While having informed the earliest occupation of the city, the river today is often invisible to its citizens. The water's value has shifted over time, resulting in a dynamic relationship with the city's fluctuating waters and building a unique mythology around its flow.
So I want to build upon Dina's comments, and in particular her attentiveness to how complex the different temporalities are that structure our relationship to the river. When we talk about the river, we're talking about it in relationship to the present that we all share, but it's also impacted by the river as it was and the river as it could be. And there's this way in which the river brings into play and brings to the fore how complex our temporal relationship to the river is. So my question for you guys to begin, I know this was intended as a very casual conversation, but Dean and I have already elaborately framed it and obsessively framed it. But I guess my question is a question that hopefully will bring all of you into conversation. Can we know the river as it was? If so, what elements do you think it's imperative that we kind of hold on to, that we remember, that we pass on, that we share with others? Is the past something in almost a methodological sense? Is the past something that we can know? And if so, what should we know, and what should we share with others? So I guess that's an opening prompt.
You know, this is something that, you know, the kind of methodological question of what we can know about non-human actors in the past is something that I've given some thought to, and sometimes I think people are skeptical, particularly people who are grounded in a very kind of textually based form of history, right, which is about going to the archives and digging up sources and reading them to understand what past people thought, you know. And then the question is, well, how can we actually get any kind of access to the thing itself? And I think rivers are particularly provocative because they flow. They have their own movement, their own energy, and they do work on the landscape in a way that, of course, a hill is active, a mountain is active, but their activity is on a pace that we have a hard time grasping. And rivers somehow flow at a pace that I think we can interact with in a way that is somehow easier to grasp, even though grasping is, of course, the wrong metaphor to use for water. But then, from my perspective, I think, you know, when we look at the past, we have our world is full of traces, right? Our world is full of traces that in some way call back to the place, to the situation of their making. And sometimes those traces are in a situation that involves humans very closely and human desires and very intimately. And sometimes it's less. You know, we can look at the landscape itself as a trace. And so my feeling is that actually if you're open to a variety of sources, visual sources, textual sources, the landscape itself, that there's no reason we can't grasp the past of a river as well as we grasp the past of a political movement or other things that are more traditional historical topics.
I think one of the things that I found very interesting about the Schuylkill in my work is that the history of its representation is so deep and so long comparatively. And it was, you know, already the subject of poetry in the 1730s and images by the 1780s and 90s, and which raises the question of, you know, the issue of metaphor and how much is really the river that we're seeing in this particular representation, and how much is what the artist wants to tell us, how much are we seeing simply a section of the river. And I think your point, Etienne, about the fact that the river flows and the trope of the river being the river of life. There's a wonderful quote by William Saunders, who was a garden designer in the 1850s and 60s here in Philadelphia, kind of writing a letter to the editor, sniffing about, you know, Central Park in New York, and saying, well, you know, Fairmount Park has the Schuylkill, which is like the river of life. And in comparison, Central Park is a granite boulder. So I think that the richness of the Schuylkill is a particular challenge and problem to cut through. It the same thing happens with the Hudson, but it seems to happen a little later on. And I think that also sets up this question of temporality, because it seems like the Schuylkill has been a river that is always flowing, that is always changing, something is always happening to it, but it seems to remain the same, or people seem not to see things happening to it. And I've often wondered why, you know, what are the factors that have created that situation?
Well, yeah, so I guess since the last 20 years, part of my work has been to interpret the river and interpret the connection of Bartram's Garden to the river. I know a lot about this. And from an archaeological sense, there's an awful lot of evidence about the river. From a geologic sense, so I mean, there are geologists who know the evolution of the Schuylkill at the end of the Ice Ages and what happened and why you find what's there. But we've done archaeology just recently, 2 or 3 years ago. We did a fairly major excavation that was funded by the airport because they were doing that wetland mitigation at Bartram's. They found carbon-14 dates roughly 5,000 years before present. So we know people were living there on the bank of the river. We know something about them, you know, small little bits, broken bits of stone, little, you know, flake points, very large reports on all this. There's an awful lot of description of the river from the first European settlement. So, and the river is where the first Europeans get into the continent to come up the Schuylkill. The Swedes start partitioning the land all from the river. You know, they take right angles off of rocks in the river. And at Bartram's, we happen to have a rock with a notch, which is a 17th century boundary marker. It appears in deeds going back at least to 1670 and perhaps earlier as well. You know, the deeds say, starting at a notch on the rock, you take a bearing so many degrees northwest and, you know, to a tree and then to another place. Well, all the trees and most of the boundary points they talk about don't exist, but the river and the rock are still there. So anyway, and people describe the plants. So one thing we've done on this restoration of wetlands, we want to try to put back the plants that were once there. And so I think one of the defining features of the Lower Schuylkill were these tidal marshes, which are mostly gone. They're fragments of the Natinicum, very degraded at Tinicum. There's fragments we've rebuilt which are not quite exactly the way it should work, but all the descriptions say there were acres and acres and acres of wild rice, and that was an ecosystem that attracted certain birds, and they were there until almost the 20th century. So that's one phase of the river. Then there's farming, which is mostly gone again on the Lower Schuylkill, but was once a major, very profitable, very lush kind of farming land and grazing land. Interesting, though, people have had an opinion, like when I grew up, the Schuylkill was almost synonymous with pollution and dirty water, and you didn't want to get in the Schuylkill. I think for most of the 20th century, and when the book, The Redemption of the Lower Schuylkill, came out, people in planning and development had decided to ignore the river, and that kind of ignoring of the river is still partly there in Philadelphians. I think people still generally probably have, some people have a bad reputation or think of the river as a bad thing. And so all the planning was to keep people away from the river, to build bridges over it, to build I-76 around the river and cut off all access to the river. So now that the river is in better shape, it's very difficult to get to the river, and you'd have to do major engineering to kind of reconfigure a way to get people down into the river. Bartram's is fortunate in that we have a very small place where you can actually walk to the bank of the river, see the tide flow in and out.
I think it's a great question, and it's one that I've been trying to contend with, and not really being able to answer, being more interested in finding ways that the photographs could begin to try to raise that question in the eyes of the viewer. And that was one of my frustrations in photographing the river that I started this project with up in Maine, the Androscoggin, which has a really similar and interesting kind of profile compared with the Schuylkill. And the frustration, basically, that I was making pictures of this place that made the river look fairly conventionally beautiful or pretty, and it didn't really get at the fact that it used to be one of the most polluted rivers in the United States, that communities all along it have turned their back on it, or these rivers like it. And how can pictures begin to try to get at the wonderful mixture of its now kind of present state of it being not such a bad place to hang out, but also it being a place where a lot of people had trouble hanging out by it 40 years ago, 100 years ago. And then if you want to go back further, you know, that was a place that people did spend lots of time and was one of the main reasons why these places were settled along its bank. So how to make pictures that show what's there, but also make some reference to what was. And the fact that these are wonderfully compelling, changing places, places that are in a constant transition, but in a specifically very important moment of transition in its experience.
So that question of context is one that I want to jump into, because I'm curious, both as a photographer going in, and you know, can we know the river as it was? When you're going and asking the question, and you know, as you're taking the photographs, recognizing that this process that Michael uses is very complicated and very chemical sensitive and temperature sensitive. It's not for the faint at heart. It's are you thinking of those historic places as you're taking the picture, or you know, what is it about actually, in a sense, capturing this moment through a lens that makes us think of them potentially as being historic moments? And I'm asking that for the whole panel, because I think that I'm asking this question about photography and capturing a moment through the lens of an artist, as well as through our own personal filters that really inform how we relate to the river on a daily basis, this invisible river.
I mean, but even to prompt you to maybe talk a little bit about like Aikens, for instance, and this way in which, you know, and Michael's is part of a long history of artists that are imaging the river, mm-hmm. That are conscious of that history of how other artists have imaged the river. But at the same time as one is imaging the river, one's also projecting perhaps onto the river a reality that may no longer be or that could be, right? So Aikens, from the little that I've understood of your thought and research via Dina, right? Aikens is imaging a river that's polluted, but it kind of comes across as pastoral in his paintings.
Yeah. Well, yes and no. He's very careful to include all those bridges and the industrial details. And I mean, I think the unsung heroes in this whole story are the people who kept rowing on the river. Mm. You know, you really wonder who would row on that river in the 1930s. Mm. and I have friends who actually have been out on the river when dead people have gone by. And so that's also a kind of part of this is that it was, you know, I think what Aikens actually is presenting a much more industrial, I think what he would call a more modern river than, say, Thomas Moran, who painted the river and whose brother photographed it. Mm. And it's really interesting that Schuylkill is very intensely photographed from really the very early years of photography in this country to about 1880, 1890, and then it sort of drops off. And you find this out if you go to eBay and just type in Fairmount or Schuylkill, and stereo views just start popping up. And the Wissahickon is the same way, very intensely photographed. And but principally certain parts of the river, so that it tends to be the waterworks, the Wissahickon, the area between the waterworks and Manayunk that became Fairmount Park. Not a lot below the dam. And so there is a particular, I mean, they're photographing the pastoral city. And what challenges photographers at this time is that if they go to Chicago or New York or Washington, they can find a nice, neatly laid out Olmstedian park that will convey the pastoral city. in Philadelphia, and this is what Aikens is painting about, there are railroads going through the park. And so it's already a compromised landscape. I think the other thing to keep in mind, too, is that when Fairmount Park was established in the 1850s into the 60s, long story short, it was a long way away from most everybody who lived in Philadelphia, because this city became so huge when they consolidated the city in 1854. Most of the people who were working in the factories lived in the eastern part of the city, and it actually was fairly expensive, and it took a long time to get to the Schuylkill. So it wasn't an easy place to get to. There weren't actually a lot of people living very close to the Schuylkill, say, in comparison to the Delaware. And that's something to sort of think about in terms of this sort of understanding and context and how people used it.
I would just say, too, at the time Eakins is painting, the water above the dam was much better quality than below the dam. So there's a structural difference in the Schuylkill. What's called the Lower Schuylkill, and why Lewis wrote this book, is that the Lower Schuylkill was just totally written off from about the 1880s onward. And the city built giant interceptor sewers to take all the city sewage from Manayunk and all the industrial neighborhoods around the pool at Fairmont. And then they dumped open into the Lower Schuylkill right below the waterworks. Mm-hmm. I mean, the water department has great photographs of these giant interceptor sewers that just dumped total raw sewage into the Lower Schuylkill. Also, the dam held up most of the water in the summer, so there was very little flow over the dam when it got really hot because they needed it all for drinking water. And that water was not treated. It was put into reservoirs and they let the silt fall out of it, but mostly it was then just pumped into the city pipes until 1911, Adam, I think, is when they shut down the Fairmount Works. So there is a difference between the upper Schuylkill water and the lower Schuylkill. Mm-hmm. And the descriptions of Bartram's Gardens in the 1880s, 90s is that, you know, in the summer it was just a total river of sewage that flowed back and forth with the tide.
Yeah. And also, you know, the upper Schuylkill above Manayunk, I mean, the chemical plants and the textile mills in Manayunk and Roxborough were dumping chemicals into the river, but there was a theory that the water was actually scoured as it went over the limestone bottom of the river, and that it became clean. And it really wasn't until the 1880s and when scientists were actually able to use microscopy and actually find bacteria and measure bacteria in the river that they began to say, hello, and that the chief engineers of the waterworks were warning people about this, from the 1860s and 70s onwards. But the leaders of industry in town were concerned about the economy and keeping their employees employed. So it's also a river of sections. I mean, once you get up to Pottsville, it's a very different place. Once you get up to Jim Thorpe, it's a very different place. And so I think that's important too.
One of the things I was struck by in just quickly perusing Lewis's book was the kinds of solutions that he was proposing to these disgusting conditions. And one of the things that really jumped out at me was, he describes putting, essentially covering over the train tracks, creating embankments. He describes shutting down the abattoir that was on the river. He describes, reorganizing the sewage system. And it's a lot of solutions that seem to me to be creating a kind of invisibility of the technological infrastructures that allow us to survive in a city. And when he describes what the Schuylkill was and what it is that it would, how it should be redeemed, what is it called? The Baptisterion, which I thought was a wonderful image. It's like a beautiful grove of oak trees with an image of kind of clean water into which you can be baptized. And I was really struck by something which, in a way, is wonderful, which is to try to clean up the river, and another way which I think contributes to some of the problems that we have, which is a kind of obscuring or a glossing over or a papering over of all those systems that we depend on to survive. And I think that one of the challenges, I should qualify this by saying that I know very little about the history of Philadelphia in particular and the Schuylkill. But I think one of the challenges in general in kind of urban planning today is how do we live with the infrastructures that we need, right? And how do we make them visible in a way that allows us to find them beautiful and allows them to be kind of sustainable and allows them to be healthy, but doesn't try to say we're going to export all of our problems to somewhere else that we can't see. And so I guess this is sort of anticipating the, like, you know, the Schuylkill of the future question, but that to me is like the issue is how do we live with our industrial infrastructures?
And I think that's one of the things that's drawn me to these rivers in the first place is the ways in which they've been, their backs, people have turned their backs to them. I think that they're hidden in plain sight. And why is that the case? And how is it that we can reconcile our expectations about place by combining or at least acknowledging that infrastructure that we need and and what it does for our lives and how in some ways it has a certain beauty to it at the same time that there are these needs for open space and for green things alongside them. And the dichotomy of that nature-culture thing is, I think, one of the reasons why we've gotten into some of the trouble that we've had with these kinds of places. I think that it tends to make us search for what I would call a purity that isn't that useful, maybe is not even reasonable to search for. So that these are places where I can see a wonderful combination of our use and the natural forces that come through and define it. And one of the reasons why the rivers, I think, are fantastic is that we talked about it already. They are these sort of embodiment of change and flux. And they're also these sites for where we come in direct contact with natural forces that we tend to want to shape or that shape us. And I should say not or, and shape us. So it's being able to reconcile that split and bring these things back together into a whole that I think is, I don't know, I one of the things that inspires me to go out and look at these places.
So I have to jump in. My head is thinking of so many questions, so Aaron's probably going to clamp me down in a minute. But I have to bring a quote that was from City Parks Association's 25th annual report. And it's the quote is, "When a river flows through a city, its condition is not and cannot be that created by nature. All its surroundings are artificial. The hand of nature has given way to that of man. The beauty of a municipal riverway depends on art and art alone." This was a quote from the same organization that published this book. So what is it we're thinking about when we call the river nature, when we're using the resources industrially, you know, later on, but early on, there was a much more intimate relationship that Joel referred to. The fact that, you know, people were irrigating their crops, they were whether they were growing rice or farming later on, you know, as we start to create the edges between the waterways and the people who are living in the in that place, what's happening there in terms of our relationship to that flowing thing of water? And you know, I'm curious because I think it helps us understand what the invisibility is about today a bit. Does anybody have any responses to that?
I was thinking Joel made an interesting point, which was the Schuylkill was a very important route into the interior of the country. And I think what's important to remember is that really, I mean, I can't talk about sort of long historical time, but certainly when the Europeans were here, it was really a roadway. I mean, it was a river to someplace, and they didn't really know where they were going initially. It was a waterway certainly for the native peoples who had lived here before. And I think that it was always a practical waterway, and it was tidal for I think 80 miles before they built the dam. And so there is that wonderful kind of combination of the, if you will, the aesthetic, do you mean the beautiful and the picturesque when you say natural, or do you mean the practical and useful? Because I mean, the model for the Schuylkill as far as, you know, what developed over time was the Thames, and there is an example of a river that's been both highly practical and used and industrialized, but also has a really powerful aesthetic identity. Just to throw something in to the conversation, and we can drop it or come back to it. It's interesting to me that when Lewis's examples of cities that have done well by their waterfronts are not all riverfronts. In fact, most of them are not riverfronts. And now, for example, if you go to the Malecón in Havana, it's one of the most odd, you know, there is this fabulous, you know, esplanade, and you look out into this huge harbor, and there's nobody there. Because there's certainly no small boats there, because small boats can go 95 miles north and get to Florida. There are large, you know, there is large shipping. But I'm thinking about, what is it you see when you're in these places, and why do you go to a certain place to see a certain view of your world around you? And I think seeing industry was something Philadelphians wanted to see for a long time in our history in the 19th century, because it was progress.
I remember last year, I can't remember exactly when it was, but there was a moment when the area right around Market Street, I think, there was the Schuylkill actually kind of flooded. And I have a friend who lives around there who the basement of his building got flooded. And, you know, there was dirt kind of all over the path and that sort of thing. And it wasn't a significant flood, right? This wasn't, I don't think, economically significant or significant in any other way. But it was, to me, striking because, you know, with the freeway on one side and the kind of park and walking and biking path on the other side, there seems something very, very artificial, right? When it's not quite the Seine, right? It's not quite like, you know, walled in on both sides. But it does feel very controlled in a way. But that moment of like kind of walking through the mud that had covered the path reminded me, like, yeah, this is a living river. This is a river that can still act and can still surprise in some ways. And to me, that is the addendum or the modification that I would make to that statement that the river in this city is an artificial river, a river of artifice and art, is that artifice and art has to remain open to the fact that the river will act, right? And there will be surprising conditions. There will be storms, there will be floods, the tides will be high. And I think, to me, that's the thing to find, is how do you find that balance of art and that other thing, which I won't call nature.
Well, yeah, and I mean, that mud is nature, so that's not what most people think of nature. Well, it's funny, too. So all the Europeans that settled on the Lower Schuylkill did things to change the shoreline. Most of those farmers built giant bulkhead walls to keep the tide out and to claim more land, because that's how an easy way to get to more land was to drain the marshes and build this river wall. So by, say, John Bartram's period, the 1750s, the Lower Schuylkill was lined on either side by these high dikes, like levees. People then used those as ways to move up and down the river because you could walk on top of them. They were about 10 feet wide. They became the routes up and down. So you had more of a pastoral landscape. I mean, yeah, but you could say that's some kind of nature. In the modern world, people like coming around Bartram's now because it's all wild and overgrown. There's all these plants. Well, they're all weed trees for the most part, or invasive weeds, but it's very green and they can be tall and you feel like you're in a wilderness. But is that nature or not? That's a good question. Mm-hmm. I mean, some people think we should fight all those invasive, you know, weed trees, ailanthus and paper mulberry, but they're what colonized. So the Lower Schuylkill on its own is in a kind of, you know, natural revival. There's a lot of animals that have come back. So again, is that nature? It's part nature and part human controlled or human created nature, but I think it's still that other thing you're talking about. Yeah.
This is a somewhat inchoate, unformed question, but over the last few months, my students and I at Penn have been thinking a lot about the river in relation to this project and Lewis's work. And one writer that we spent a lot of time with was writer Rob Nixon, who has written this really extraordinary book called Slow Violence on the Environmentalism of the Poor. And it looks at how the kinds of activities, the pollution that Lewis is upset about, right? The violence that represents to those that live in the city and those that live near the city. Well, that violence today is harder to pinpoint. It's harder to visualize. It's harder to see, but it's still there. That pollution remains part of the life of the river, even as it isn't necessarily as iconic and legible as it is in that photograph we used for this project, where you see. And you would be able to speak to this better, but you see kind of the river literally full of debris. So I guess I don't really have a fixed, straightforward question here, but how do you grapple with that kind of that past? Many of you talked about the the roads, the highways that border the river. We've talked about how it's controlled in many respects, at least on certain sides. So how do we grapple with that past, which is a violence towards the river, and a violence that isn't easy to dismiss or kind of file away? There's a durability to it. It's hard to unravel it and to move beyond it. So I don't know, again, if there's a question here, but how do we deal with that violent past? The river as it was is a river of a destructiveness towards the river, and it's one that, for all of our desires, it's very hard to move beyond. So.
I think it's, I mean, I would be a little cautious to label it so quickly that way, because I think that it's a privileged position to be able to talk about how what happened to it in the past was violence, and how it needs to sort of be considered as something that was really bad. I mean, yeah, I think it's really lamentable that the river was close to being dead for a variety of reasons, but there were a lot of people that were making really good livings from the industry that that existed along the river and that could really only exist along the river. And so that there's a very complicated relationship of, how do I call it, of progress and of loss and change when you talk about the industry going away and it changing into something else. And, you know, it's similar to the issues that I see up in Maine with the Androscoggin River as well. There are, you know, a lot of people that were able to send their kids to college by working in the paper mills. And, you know, there are no jobs up there for that really anymore. So it's really hard to make clean cut and easy statements about the trade-offs, is I guess the thing I'm saying is, and it might have been violent. It also was, it gave us the city in some ways.
I think we have to remember there were very different perceptions of proximity and proximics. when you remember that, you know, the neighborhood that we call Fairmount and Callow Hill and the like were immediately adjacent to what some of the world's largest factories of the time. And I think, following Michael's point, people didn't stop swimming in the Schuylkill. As Joel said, it was worse below the dam, but it was still pretty bad, and certainly by the 80s and the 90s. And I think, you know, you could say people didn't know any better. Well, actually, they didn't in many respects, and it was where they'd always gone. And there were certainly debates going on about this, but something that I discovered in my work was the how persistent certain people, like the chief engineers, were about saying, you know, the river, we're really destroying the river here, and that nothing happened because of the constituencies and the interest groups that were working together, and because people really just didn't, you know, seemed not to see it. So I think that's certainly something, if you're thinking about going back and understanding what the river was like, that we see things nowadays perhaps that people in the past didn't. I remember when the waterworks, the first sort of iteration of restoring the waterworks, which took place in the late 70s, early 80s, and they opened it as a cafe in like 1980, yeah, somewhere there. And went there for lunch on a hot July day, and oh boy, it was like, oh, this is not going to happen. So there was a step towards improving things, but a lot had to happen in other regards, like cleaning up the river so that the stench was not so bad. But you know, it's possible that in, you know, years gone by, I grew up in a city with pulp and paper mills, and we just didn't smell it after a while.
Mm-hmm. So I had two quick things I wanted just to say in response to those ideas. And you know, one of the things that I like about Nixon's work is that it's not just about slow violence, but it's also about, I don't know if he actually uses this term, but about like slow activism, right? That you can be slowly worn down by pollution, desertification, erosion, and you can slowly build up again by planting trees one by one, right? And so that, to me, is a nice way of also thinking about the temporality of damage and activism, that it doesn't always have to be the revolutionary action on either side. But I think, you know, like, to me, like, what is most important about that kind of work is that it adds a concern with justice and power to what can sometimes seem like a pretty abstract discussion about the nature-culture divide. Mm. And it actually shows us that the nature-culture divide in many of its instantiations has been a way of mm-hmm. hiding mm-hmm. power relations. Mm-hmm. I mean, Raymond Williams mm-hmm. said this 40 years ago, that there's a lot of human history in the idea of nature, and that the control over nature is often the control over of man over man, right, of humanity over humanity. So that's one thing that I really like about that kind of work. Mm-hmm. And now I've probably forgotten the second thing I wanted to say. Oh, no, it came back. So one of the limits, I think, one of the problems with thinking about a river is if we start thinking about it as a confined place, right, a place that is isolated, a place that's not part of a system. And that can lead us to look at something like the greening of the Schuylkill as an unqualified good, right? That's just great. Nothing wrong with that. But of course, you know, as you point out, the reason the Schuylkill can be greened is that there aren't big factories there anymore. Mm-hmm. Well, where are the factories? They're somewhere else, right? Where is the sewage? It's somewhere else. Where is the you know, the energy production that makes all of this run? It's somewhere else. And so I think one of the things that a more systemic viewpoint can bring to us is the fact that, you know, just tracing the river itself can give us a false narrative, and that we actually need to incorporate, you know, we need to move beyond the river. We need to see the river not as a place but as a connection, right, to all these other, even if it's not literally, you know, full of barges going up and down with goods from China or whatever, but those connections are still there.
Yeah, I think, interestingly, the Lower Schuylkill still is maybe 50% industrial, though, so it's a point where you could combine both greening and mm-hmm. industry. So there is a power plant just below the South Street Bridge. It's a major power plant, still mm-hmm. active. Yeah. There's a giant oil refinery across the river that's not going away in the near future. Maybe 50 years it'll go away. The railroads are still there in vast amounts. So there is, and even the sewage treatment plant is not that far away. Nobody knows. One problem about Philadelphians is they don't know about their sewage treatment plants. So they act like the sewage just goes somewhere. But there's a very complex process that, again, Adam could tell us all about that, that it might be better if people did know more about it. Mm-hmm. You know, the public hardly ever goes to those plants. Maybe there's an open house once a year or something, if there even is, I don't know. But anyway, so you could still combine those.
I never get down there.
Yeah, yeah.
But what I think is interesting in your comments, and that circles back to the beginning, where you were talking also, I can't remember, I think it was you, Joel, talking about access to the river.
Yeah.
Not actually being there. And the fact that, you know, your point of the degree to which it's still industrialized, I think it's a really great one. And what comes with that, frustratingly for me, trying to photograph the river, is the fact that those entities make it really difficult for you to access the river. To get
they won't let you on their property under any circumstances, yes.
Yeah, especially with a camera. So I think it's a great point. Yeah.
There is just to tap into that, you know, you can't ignore the title of the book or this incredibly moralistic tone that Lewis is bringing to the conversation, which is something that, following up on what Etienne is saying, has been talked about in terms of how we even think about our relationship to the environment today. I'm going to use that in the broadest sense, whether it's our waterways or our land or, you know, our relationship to climate change, whatever it might be, that tone is something that both sets this moralistic and narrative that in fact obscures some of the power relationships, as you said, that are there. Do you have anything that we could learn from Lewis's voice from that time? Is there anything we can learn from that? Or do you think it's just as, you know, to be taken for what it is?
Well, Lewis was one of a small group of men who had access to an amazing amount of power to reshape the city. Another one was a man named Eli Kirk Price II, who essentially built the Parkway and the Art Museum. I mean, was really... but interestingly, was never the president of the organization. He was always the vice president because he could work more effectively behind the scenes. So there, something that is, it's a history of every city, but it, Philadelphia's history of the effectively the tension between certain groups in the city, and particularly at the beginning of the 20th century, how certain groups of people were able to affect significant change in the physical geography of the city, the Parkway being the most dramatic change, I think, and tried to affect similar change with the Schuylkill and the Delaware embankments as well, is he's speaking to the choir when he delivers this speech to the City Parks Association, and he's speaking from a position of considerable power. He's not somebody who's just concerned. And so the other part of this history that's really interesting is why it didn't go anywhere. What happened? They built the Parkway, they built the Art Museum, and everything seemed to be happening in the 20s. I think what happened was 1929. Mm-hmm. And, you know, everything came to a screeching halt. But, yeah, there's Etienne's really put his finger on it. I mean, the power dynamics in this are a really interesting part of the story.
Yeah, and there was a considerable effort to design parkways and bridges and things for the Lower Schuylkill as part of that book. And I think City Parks may have funded that work. They had plans by Paul Cray and Zansinger and Boire, the same people that did the Parkway. I think one problem is they found the Parkway cost a lot more than they ever expected, and that had been going on for 20 years when they did this, and this was even more ambitious. I mean, in retrospect, if you look back at planning, it would have been better if they didn't build the Parkway and they actually did the Schuylkill development, although at that point the river was so polluted it would never have happened. I mean, but that's another whole thing right to talk about. But it is interesting that it actually largely failed, except maybe the building of 30th Street and the post office at 30th Street, which mm-hmm. really aren't in his plans, but that was the beginning of moving south along the bank of the river. And those two buildings, you know, they're building those. I always find amazing is they're building those buildings during the Depression. They're completed, like, I don't know, 1930, 1931. It was like the Depression hadn't even happened. They're building these incredible palaces to the railroad and the government right there at 30th Street. And then nothing happens beyond that. Yeah.
Maybe I just ask one last question, building upon Dina's, to Etienne. So what do you make of this kind of evangelical tinge to Lewis's writing, or project maybe more generally, more abstractly, which is part of maybe a Philadelphia vernacular, right? This kind of very evangelical kind of desire to redeem the city from itself, redeem the river from itself, redeem all of us from our own iniquities. I don't know, how does Lewis's work speak to you today, or how do you record it?
I'm not sure how Philadelphia that is. It seems to me very typical of a lot of urban reform rhetoric of the time, typical of the conservation movement of the time. You know, if you look even at somebody like Gifford Pinchot, right, a kind of scientific forester, and as he starts, and governor of Pennsylvania, right, obviously, you know, as he starts to move beyond forestry, he uses an almost evangelical language to talk about the possibilities of conservation for not just saving the forest, but also saving the nation and perhaps even the souls of the nation's members. But I guess there's this broader question of like, what can we do with this redemptive language? And I have to say, like, for me, there's something about the language of the fall and the redemption that is unappealing. Mm-hmm. Right? It suggests the possibility of a return to an Edenic
yep.
state, mm-hmm. and exactly that purity.
Yeah, and which has a parallel with recent conversations about the restoration of the rivers, which basically implies prelapsarian, you know, purity. I mean, it's restoring it to what? And is that even, you know, how much is that a false or even sort of problematic goal, right?
Mm. But I mean, I guess I'm trying to look on the positive side, and I would say one thing that I do like about that language is that it says this is more than just a matter of instrumentalism. This is more than just a utilitarian question of how do we make sure that we don't get sick, right? Mm-hmm. Because of the flies coming out of the abattoir or the sewage, and it's saying this is actually about our souls. This is about beauty. This is about what it's like to live as a community. And so I would say that if I had to take something away from it, despite my distaste for some of that language, that's what I would try to take away.
Thank you. Does anybody have any questions that they'd like to add to the mix?
We'll bring the mic over.
One of the things I'd like to add to what looking at the Lewis book, and that is that with patience, a lot can happen, but you have to be patient. Mm-hmm. You know, Philadelphians have a love of considering themselves more sinful than any population anywhere else, but nevertheless, things move along. You know, Lewis wrote in 24. It took 40 years for it to get on the city plan when Ed Bacon put it on the city plan in 63. It took another 15 for ground to be broken on the first section of Schuylkill Park in 79. And it took a lot more years since then for the park slowly and continuously to be developed. And here we are, 90 years after the redemption of the Lower Schuylkill, and we're seeing a tremendous amount of it's a wonderful environment that mixes the urban and the pastoral in this very almost sublime way. One of the reasons the trail is so loved is because it combines the pastoral. You know, you're practically touching the river, and at the same time you got the Cira Center across the way, and that's the reason that a million people go down that trail, and that started on day one that trail opened. So I guess if you've been working on it long enough, it does give you some optimism that over time you can, in fact, accomplish what Lewis dreamed of.
Or maybe we're talking about it now because it happened, and it happened that he called for it. I don't know about the causality necessarily. I don't know, but I don't live here. So.
My question is less about the Schuylkill River, like that particular channel, and more about the Schuylkill's tributaries and to what degree Lewis explores those, or what our relation to those should be now, since there are blessed few first, second order streams that are still above ground, and what how that fits into the broader system.
Adam can answer that as well. I'd just say very quickly that an interesting aspect of the development of the Philadelphia's park system is that several tributaries of the Schuylkill were preserved, the Wissahickon being one. There are others, the Lower Merion Conservancy, for example, is working to preserve Mill Creek that's in Lower Merion. But as you mentioned, many of the tributaries have been covered over, and one of the aspects of the Penn Praxis plan for East and West Fairmount Park was how to open some of the those small creek valleys and dells to bring those back into to kind of recover them and renovate them so they give access to the river. But Adam, do you want to talk about that a bit? Because it's I think the Fairmount Park Commission had a big role to play in tributaries within the city, at least. Yeah.
You know, I usually talk for an hour about that.
But I know. It's okay.
And you can hear him tomorrow night, Friends of the Wissahickon, as they're, Adam Levine will be speaking at 6 o'clock. Yeah.
Well, most of the tributaries were put into sewers to drain the neighborhoods that were built in the watershed of the Schuylkill through the city. There are a few in the park, as Lily said, that are still above ground. But even those, any stream, like the quote Dina read about any river that flows through a city is compromised, any tributary of a small tributary of a river that flows through a city is even more compromised if it's not completely obliterated, which was the term the engineers used when they managed to get these streams put into pipes and off the landscape so they could build the city around them without interference in a way. Mm-hmm. Literally, this is what I've been researching for the past 20 years almost. So I don't want to belabor that. But I just wanted to clear up a little something about the infrastructure. It's nice to think of infrastructure bringing it to the surface, bringing it to view, and making it attractive. But nobody really wants to look at a sewer. Nobody wants to smell a sewer. And the practical aspect of cleaning up the Lower Schuylkill was building interceptor sewers and sewage treatment plants to treat the sewage. So of all the technologies, I suppose, that are questionable, that the panel was saying, well, maybe this was good, maybe that this was not good, I think the building of the sewage treatment system and finally finishing that in the 1950s and 60s was not, there was no question that in an urban environment that was only a good. And I don't think anybody, it's might be interesting from just to, I've been in sewers, walked in them, and I don't think it's something that the average person really would care to do.
But in Paris.
I don't know. I would say some people would, though, I think, but it's hard to say. I mean, I've been at those plants, too, and they're different than people would expect.
No, the plants I can see, and I think every person in any city should go into a...
Yeah, in fact, the Northeast plant with their early 20th century plant, they unfortunately tore down all the early stuff, which was an incredible kind of Piranesian ruin with tunnels and stuff that they could have made an amusement park, but not that the water department would ever think to do that, but yeah. And I'm sure there's also health and security reasons for letting people generally into sewers, but yeah.
Actually, I want to make one comment about the tributary question, and that what's interesting is that I don't really know how much Lewis knew about the hydrological systems here in Philadelphia. You know, how long the term riparian buffer has been around, and the fact that we have so many tributaries right between, because we are between the Delaware and the Schuylkill rivers here, that our land that our city is functionally working on or built on is threaded with these tributaries. So I'm not sure, either he was knowledgeable about that because he was an extraordinary well-read man, or whether he just decided to put his effort into making Philadelphia the world-class city by trying to imitate the Thames or the Seine or places in Europe. That's unclear to me.
By the time he wrote the book, most of the tributaries that were going to be of the Delaware and the Schuylkill were pretty much gone by then. Of the Schuylkill, and that includes the tributaries in southwest Philadelphia and what were marshlands, and in south Philadelphia that were marshlands too. The only real tributary left is in FDR Park. Still, the lake there is part of an old tidal stream. But that whole area was, Joel was talking about marshland. There were 20 square miles of marshland in Philadelphia out of 129 square miles of land. And you could count it in acres now, not even a square mile. And Tinicum mostly is in Delaware County. It's in the neighboring county, so that doesn't really change. So it's just an incredible transformation of the landscape that was undertaken to build the city, and that it's undertaken to build any city. So it's still going on, cities being built today, or countries like China being developed today are doing the same thing to their rivers and to their landscapes, to their old neighborhoods, and on and on.
Maybe we have time for one more question. Anybody have a question they'd like to? Yes, Nick. Yay.
Yeah, so I really want to return to the quote that you took from the 1913 report from the City Parks Association, right, about the role of art, in shaping the river, and even maybe having a kind of redemptive value, you know, of having art, or you know, thinking about the river as art. So in that case, how does that relate to our contemporary times? You know, like, you know, that report was written more than a century ago, right? You know, how can kind of, I don't know, like bioengineered landscapes and, you know, hydrophonic waterscapes become part of this aesthetic, artistic project that might redeem, like, the Lower Schuylkill? But
Well, I mean, I can't speak for anyone but me, and the desire that I have in the middle of this is just to try to bring forward some experience directly with some of these places and have it become a more complicated experience, as opposed to it being simply fallen or redeemed, right? And I think that I think that the question of looking and spending time, there's no substitute for it, and so that whether you make art from that or whether it encourages people to spend time just in the presence of the subject itself, that's, you know, I think that's what matters the most. I don't think that the distinction between art and life is altogether that helpful sometimes. I think one thing kind of comes from the other. And so if pictures of a place, for instance, cause people to spend more time thinking about it and going to it, then that's great.
Yeah, if I can just say one thing, I was, which I think follows on the point about art and life, I was just rereading Robert Smithson's Frederick Law Olmsted and the Dialectical Landscape essay. And at the end, he's talking about Central Park, and he talks about the pond being like full of mud and like a half-submerged shopping cart, and you know, and he says maybe what we need is mud dredging art, right? We can do an art project that actually involves dredging the mud out, moving it to some place in the city that needs soil, and you know, he's basically taking what would be a dredging project and just calling it art. But there's something I really like about it, because it is rejecting the idea that what it would be to do art or make art on the river would be to build a beautiful building with like neoclassical columns or put up a piece of public art or something, right? There's, I think, many other ways in which an artistic engagement with the river could bring it alive and bring new perspectives to it. For me, that's what that would mean now versus maybe what it would have meant at the end of the 19th or early 20th century.
I think the thing to keep in mind, too, is where do we see art? I think I was at a performance, I guess, two summers ago, with Invisible River, on the Schuylkill, and people were dancing on the banks of the river, and a flotilla of rowing shells and kayaks and, you know, sort of arrived at the same time, and it was really, really exciting. And I would venture that maybe 5% of the people in the not inconsiderable crowd that was watching this came from the neighborhood. They were not from Strawberry Mansion. And I think that engaging with the river involves people experiencing the river as a safe and welcoming place, and I think that's been happening. And that art may be something that's about, instead of erecting monuments, it's about starting conversations just like this one, and you know, getting the conversation out and more people involved in that conversation in different places. And so they begin to kind of look around and see where it is they live, and they think about it and what it means to them in their lives and how other people think about it. And that there can be interventions within that space in a certain way, but perhaps more and more the interventions are community-based and not one person giving a speech about how things should change, but really about bringing people together to talk about ideas. And that I think that might be the art of you know, 21st century art.